This webcast is a service of SDPB. More information at sd.net.
The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable Chief Justice Stephen R. Jensen presiding, is now in session.
You may be seated. Thank you. Good morning. The first case set for argument this morning is appeal number 30698, Craig Nelson et al. Versus Gary Tinkham. Justin Bergeson is arguing on behalf of the appellants. And Justin Peterson is also present. And we have Joel Rishi, who will be arguing on behalf of appellees. Each side will have 15 minutes for your initial argument. And then, Mr. Bergeson, you'll have a five-minute rebuttal. You can proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Justin Bergeson. I represent the estate of Dr. Earl Nelson through its personal representatives, Craig Nelson and Amy Freed. The issue before the court today is straightforward. It's whether to reverse an improvidently granted motion to dismiss that disposed of the Nelson estate's complaint, pleading that they owned a business interest in the coins and collectibles business in the Empire Mall, and ownership of certain valuables that they kept there under an agreement with the late Mr. Tinkham. Reversal is warranted and appropriate for three reasons. First, the circuit court erroneously failed to comply with its standard of review, meaning that it failed to assume all the facts, all the facts pled by the Nelson Estate's complaint as true and construe all inferences from those facts in favor of the Nelson Estate. Baked into that standard of review is an abstention from resolving jury questions, like questions of reasonableness, which the court erroneously did when it found that the Nelson Estate's conduct in relying on Mr. Tinkham's representations that they owned a business and would be compensated for it were not reasonable or in good faith. Second, the circuit court committed error by resolving that accrual of the Nelson Estate's claims are governed by partnership law and probate law. The Nelson Estate's claims, as pled in their complaint, are for breach related to the business ownership and conversion of items. Thank you. The parties don't dispute that 15.2.13 governs the statute of limitations here, and under that general accrual analysis, under multiple cases that this court has decided that requires notice of an injury or legal wrong. Third, the circuit court committed error by resolving that equitable tolling did not apply when the Nelson estate actually raised equitable estoppel and fraudulent concealment as grounds to estop, not toll the statute of limitations, but estop the defendants from raising the statute of limitations defense in the first place based on Mr. Tinkham's representations.
You seem to make some arguments in your brief that there was procedural error in this case because the court decided this on a judgment on the pleadings when an answer hadn't been filed yet. Is that something that you're asserting, or do you think that makes any difference in this case?
That does. So the distinction between the motion to dismiss and motion for judgment on the pleadings is more of a clarification of the record, that a motion to dismiss is filed before an answer is filed and a motion for judgment on the pleadings is after.
But in the end, does it really matter? It's the same standard.
So the question
really is, did the court apply the right standard here? Did the court construe all the facts most favorable in the pleading to the non-moving party? That's really your issue. I mean, does it make any difference if the court dismisses this on the pleadings rather than as a motion to dismiss? I know there are different rules, but in the end, if the court was right or wrong, does it really matter? Because it's the same standard.
Yeah, that's correct. It is the same standard. The distinction comes with, perhaps some labeling with the application of a statute of limitations defense before an answer is filed.
I wonder if we have to correct our decision in Guthmiller, though, because Guthmiller seemed to suggest that that was a meaningful distinction. I don't know that the federal courts really agree with that. I don't know that they've really applied that, and they seem to look at it a little more broadly as you and the Chief were just talking about it. I don't know. Maybe we have to adjust Guthmiller. Any thoughts on that?
So I think that Guthmiller, what is argued as dicta, I don't think is dicta. And first, I think that the statute, South Dakota state law, maybe this is why the federal courts have a distinction, under 15.2.1, We have a specific rule that says a statute of limitations defense can only be raised by a responsive pleading. And then in 1568C, South Dakota state law specifically lists a statute of limitations defense among the other affirmative defenses that must be pled and on which a defendant has the burden of proof. So I think there is a distinction there between...
But my question is really maybe more, in the end, is a more practical one, which is, do you really, let's say we reverse it on that ground, do you really want to go back down and re-argue the case in front of the court, file your answer, and then come back up and talk about the statute of limitations, or do we just address it now because everything's in front of us?
That's right. So, I mean, that's why we have all the briefing on the merits of the case. So I think that the statute of limitations issue is enough by itself, but in the broader sense of this case, we don't want to be back arguing the same exact thing. So we are looking for
Is that the same answer for the defenses to statute of limitations? Do you think that the record that we have, so the circuit court didn't address, your argument is the circuit court didn't address your two arguments to avoid the statute of limitations, going with equitable tolling instead. Do we have the record? Do you think that we should decide the case on the record since the circuit court didn't, because the arguments have been made?
So, I mean, I think what you're asking is, is the initial question enough, or do we proceed to the other issues, including the equitable tolling and equitable estoppel issues? I think the record is enough for the court to make its own decision on the equitable estoppel problem and really all the
same for fraudulent concealment?
Yes. Based on it's all based on the allegations of the complaint, which are assumed true, and I think there's the record to support that.
Turning your attention to the accrual question,
yes.
Why doesn't partnership law control the accrual date?
So, as we addressed in our brief, there's quite a few main reasons. So, the most glaring one is Partnership Statute 405C, and no unequivocal terms. 405C says that the accrual of and any time limitation on a right of action for a remedy under this section is governed by other law. That explicitly means that the general accrual rules apply. I mean, again, there's no dispute that 15213 applies here to govern accrual. There's no reason to depart from those standards to say that dissociation automatically causes accrual regardless of notice of an injury or legal wrong. And that's explicitly what the defendants are arguing. I'd like to turn the court's attention to page 15 of their brief before this court, which says that dissociation is the triggering point at which a dissociated partner's rights are set and enforceable, and therefore when the claim accrues. That's simply irreconcilable with 405C. The argument is that dissociation, a concept unique to partnership law, or at least in this case applying to partnership law, automatically constitutes accrual, despite 405C explicitly saying that accrual is governed by non-partnership law.
I don't have that page of the brief pulled up. What is their primary authority for that proposition?
I think it's just the language of the statute. I don't think there's any case law that they cite to. That's another thing. I mean, this is applying the partnership statutes this way appears to be novel. The Revised Uniform Partnership Act is a model act that 34 other states, the District of Columbia and the U.S. Virgin Islands, have each adopted, most of them around the late 90s and early 2000s. So we have, don't hold me to the math, but about 600 years of Revised Uniform Partnership Act enactment, and there's no case law that they present that shows that they modify a state's statute of limitations.
Is
like
it really,
this.
Though, I mean, so the statute says that this, you know, this doesn't govern accrual, or accrual can be determined under other legal principles in state law. The other legal principles are the claim accrues when you know you've got a claim. So now what? You know you've got a claim because, and this isn't really an adversarial case, right? I mean, so many of our accrual cases are plaintiff versus defendant, or there's a claim. And so this is a little bit different. I don't know that it's a difference in kind. Maybe it's one in degree, but it's just a little bit different. And so we're really focusing on what kind of awareness they had that they had something, right? That they had a claim. How about that?
Right. So, I mean, respectfully, I think this is an adversarial case because the claims are for breach and for Mr. Tinkham and the Tinkham estate.
It wasn't initially, but in any event.
It wasn't initially, but
I'm reading it, right?
Right, and that's where the estoppel defenses come in. But even then, if you look at it as a non-adversarial case, the questions are a question of fact. Is what facts did the Nelson estate know at the time their dad died that made it so they knew they had a claim? And at that time, as we briefed and as alleged in the First Amendment amended complaint, the only things that they knew are that he died and that he had some kind of ownership in this business. And ultimately, it's for a jury to decide whether that's sufficient notice for their claim.
So under your rule, though, I'm sorry, we can ask you something. So under your rule, though, as you've kind of proposed it here, then the personal representatives for Dr. Nelson would be sort of able to forestall accrual unilaterally. They could say, you know, we're gonna hold off. We don't want accrual just yet. We'll think about accrual later. And we know we have these rights, but we're going to push those off down the road. That seems like that would be maybe not a good way to have certainty and clarity in terms of accrual for this class of cases.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, respectfully, I don't think that that was all just on them. We've briefed about Partnership Statute 701 that shows that the remaining partner is just as motivated to resolve these issues due to the accrual.
No, but it's their claim,
interest.
And we're talking about accrual from their perspective. So you know, this is their deal. This is their claim.
Right, and so they didn't bury their heads in the sand or anything like that. It's ultimately, it's a jury question on whether those facts were sufficient notice.
But to my question, then are they the unilateral sort of sources of when accrual begins? They can determine that in and of themselves without any sort of principle that would guide us, and we're just in courts just sort of are left to sort of figure out when they decided accrual occurred?
No, I mean, I think that's where the jury question comes into play, that it's a question of fact for the jury, and it's not necessarily for the courts to decide. The 12 everyday people would decide if the facts that the Nelson estate was presented with is sufficient to constitute accrual.
The rights they're seeking to enforce aren't rights directly against, you know, I know you've got estoppel theories and some things like that, but the rights they're seeking to enforce are the partnership rights that have been in existence for like a decade by the time this rolls around. So those are the rights, and I guess that's what I'm driving at. If there is that sense that a partner, an associate partner or a successor, a state could and had these rights, can they just hold off on that and then litigate stale-ish claims 10, 12 years down the road when they get ready to it?
Right. I mean, I think that the partnership statutes, they authorize that private right of action, but I don't know if automatically saying that dissociation constitutes accrual comports with the notice of injury and legal wrong standard for 15.2.13. There needs to be some other notice. And again, too, I mean, specifically citing the Eastside Lutheran case with the church construction, different claims can accrue at different times under the same contract. And there's been no authority presented that even assuming that there was some sort of accrual for their right to a buyout automatically upon dissociation, that the Nelson estate is somehow precluded from bringing claims for breach related to their ownership interest.
So I wonder if that, I don't know, as I think about it, if that doesn't tie in more to your equitable claims. Let's assume it accrued as claimed in this case by the, or is determined by the trial court. Why do you win on the equitable theories? How do you win on those in terms of this motion?
Right. So the equitable estoppel cases apply to a culpable defendant's conduct, and here the Nelson estate did what reasonable people would do. Hey, we know our dad had an interest in this business. Let's go talk to his business partner and see what he says. So they went to him, and he said, under the assumed true facts of the First Amended complaint, yes, your dad was an owner of this business. I will make things right and compensate you later. And if he never intended to do that, or if he sometime changed his mind, he made those representations to the Nelson estate, and they relied on those.
Did you argue that he had? Is there some place where you allege that he had, in fact, withheld information of some kind, that he didn't intend to do that?
So that shows why equitable estoppel is a fact question as well and is inappropriate to resolve on a motion to dismiss.
But is it sufficiently pled in any way through the arguments you made to the court or the documents you submitted to the court? What is there that I would look at in the record that would point me to something that says Dr. Tinkham didn't intend to do that?
So I think that's where, I mean, the Nelson estate can't know the intentions necessarily at this stage of the case, but that's where the reasonable inferences from the motion to dismiss come from. If he told them these things and he never did them, then he must have not intended to actually pay them. And so, I mean, that's why on the equitable estoppel issue, there needs to at least be some consideration for the grounds that the Nelson estate actually raised. And there's authority from this court saying that it's a question of fact as well and should go to the jury. I have about 10 seconds here. I'd like to wrap up. So accordingly, for all these reasons, the Nelson estate respectfully requests this court reverse the circuit court's dismissal and remand for further proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Rishi, you can proceed with your argument.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Joel Rishi. I'm here arguing on behalf of Eddie Welch and the Mere Coin Company, LLC, as well as Gary Tinkham, the personal representative of the estate of William Bill Tinkham. Appellees respectfully request this court affirm the circuit court's decision below granting judgment on the pleadings and dismissing plaintiff's claims against Welch and Tinkham in this matter. The circuit court properly determined that a dissociated partner's claim for a buyout or distribution of his interest in a partnership accrues at the time of the partner's dissociation, which is the event that creates the right to a buyout or a distribution. In this case, if Earl Nelson was in fact a partner in the coins and collectibles business, he was dissociated at the time of his death on March 13, 2013. His death triggered that dissociation, and they did not bring a claim to assert his interests or his rights in that business for more than a decade, and therefore it was barred by the statute of limitations. First, address the procedural issues that were raised, and then I'll move on to the accrual question, which I think is the really important question in this matter. The circuit court didn't err by evaluating this motion as a motion for judgment on the pleadings as opposed to a motion to dismiss. As the court pointed out, the standard is identical. The real question is whether the statute of limitations defense is established on the face of the pleadings. In this case, it is, because the material facts to the accrual question were pled in the plaintiff's amended complaint. Earl Nelson claims a business interest in the partnership or a business interest in coins and collectibles. He died on March 13, 2013. That led to accrual. There's no dispute that this action wasn't brought until more than a decade later in the summer of 2023. The material facts are right there in the complaint. I think to address the Guthmiller question, Guthmiller itself doesn't change the general rule that sets out in Hernandez that says, you know, where the allegations show on the face of the complaint that there is some insuperable bar to relief, then dismissal is appropriate. And that standard would apply just the same in a motion for judgment on the pleadings as it would in a motion to dismiss. And so I do think Guthmiller could be clarified, because that language that I believe is dicta creates some confusion there. But this court has never really applied a rule that says you can't bring a statute of limitations defense on a motion to dismiss or a motion for judgment on the pleadings, et cetera. It's affirmed granting of motion to dismiss on multiple occasions.
Counsel, so if we agree with your argument as to when accrual starts for the breach of contract claims, why should it, so we have two different equitable theories. We have the affirmative defenses to the statute of limitations application, but there were also a number of equitable claims in the complaint itself. So why, if we agree with the accrual on the breach of contract claims, did that also warrant dismissal of the other equitable claims, the unjust enrichment, the promissory estoppel, the quantum merit, those types of claims?
The unjust enrichment promissory estoppel, quantum merit claims all arise out of this alleged interest in the business, and so they are asserting rights that arise out of that business interest, and they have the same six-year statute of limitations. What they're saying is Earl Nelson contributed somehow to this business, and Bill Tinkham was unjustly enriched by that. Well, either way, those are Earl Nelson's claims, and they would have arisen at the latest at the time of his death. There's no way for him to assert them after his death. But the claims arise at the same time as the rest of his business interest claims do.
Would that be the same for the promissory estoppel? And that gets kind of similar to the equitable estoppel defense. Is there a distinction between those?
I don't think there's a distinction between Earl Nelson's claims, whether they're equitable or legal. The business interest is Earl Nelson's business interest. He was associated at the time of his death, and therefore his claims for any claim under any theory, whether it's legal or equitable, arose at the time of his death.
What about the arguments that even if you're right under your theory of when the business claims accrued, that the statute can either be told or you should be stopped from asserting it? And kind of been working through those two doctrines, equitable estoppel and fraudulent concealment. I'll confess, it's hard to really separate them. It seems like one is doing very much what the other one's doing under a different name, and the elements are really pretty similar sounding. So in any event, what about those defenses that would either stop you or toll it? Is there that you believe doesn't apply here?
First, thank you, Your Honor. The equitable tolling question, I think, is answered by the statute itself. You know, Justice Conan Camp in her concurrence.
And then there's equitable tolling. I'm sorry to interrupt you. And then there's equitable tolling, which the brief sort of suggests is another deal entirely. So throw equitable tolling into the batch of equitable estoppel and fraudulent concealment, and we'll try to sort it out. I'm not sure if there are big distinctions. And yes, Justice Kohnekamp.
If we look at the common denominator between equitable tolling, equitable estoppel, fraudulent concealment, the question is, was there some extraordinary circumstance that prevented the plaintiffs from knowing or asserting their claims? And in this case, no equitable circumstance, no extraordinary circumstance did that, right? Because
well,
the fraudulent...
I see a extraordinary circumstance in these elements. You know, I'm looking at equitable estoppel. You can have a representation or a concealment. You can have either one. And maybe the concealment is similar to fraudulent concealment. But let's say you have a representation, which is alleged here. Hey, don't worry about it. I'll take care of you either when I sell the business or when I die, you'll get paid out of the partnership. So that's made. Plaintiffs claim they don't know otherwise. They claim they relied on it. Why doesn't equity come in that situation and toll or stop the statute from running if, in fact, it accrued?
That representation didn't interfere or hinder the plaintiff's knowledge of knowing their claim existed. In fact, under the allegations, Bill Tinkham acknowledged, allegedly, that there was a business interest there. So even with those representations, the plaintiffs were aware that their dad claimed a business interest in the coins and collectibles business, that he died. The statute says he was dissociated, and he had a right to payout, which they allege.
If they knew or they should have known or they knew that it had already accrued, the statute had already run, when would you ever have a estoppel? If someone made a representation and said, I'm going to take care of you out of this, don't worry about it, and when one of these two events happen, I'll make sure that you get paid.
If someone made a representation that misrepresented the existence of the claim, then maybe you would have an estoppel claim, right?
You're saying it only applies if there's a misrepresentation of the estoppel claim or the statute versus a statement, I'm going to pay you when one of these events takes place, and you and you rely on that and don't proceed?
I do, and there's a couple of reasons for that, Your Honor.
You have authority to that effect?
Well, first of all, the general accrual authority says your claim arises when you have knowledge of the facts of the elements of your claim, right? And so the injury here is we have not been paid our dad's partnership interests, which were owed. Now, maybe Bill Tinkham said, I'll get you at some time in the future. I analogize this to a promissory note, right? A bank has a promissory note. It's due on a date certain, or maybe it's due on automatic acceleration. They go to the debtor, and they say, your note's due. It's time to pay. The debtor says, don't worry. I got money coming in a few weeks or a few months. I'll pay you then. The bank's claim is still ripe. They could still assert it. No one's saying that they don't have a claim that they couldn't bring at that time. It's accrued. In fact, this court has held that when on a promissory note like that, if the parties are still working it out, the claim accrues at the time of default, right? And this is very similar in this case. There's a business interest. He's saying, oh, they're alleging that he said, I'll get you at some time in the future. Well, if that's the case, you know, a debtor on a promissory note could always defer a lawsuit against them by just promising to pay at some point in the future.
But isn't it the opposite scenario we hear? It's where if you have a scenario where the creditor is saying, well, we'll give you more time.
But
I mean, there's case law that says that can affect when the obligations are due.
And
so why aren't we looking at it in that perspective?
Because ripeness and accrual are the flip side of the same coin, right? Your claim isn't ripe until all the elements are present. Your claim hasn't accrued until all elements are present.
Okay, so well, then there's the difference between the equitable tolling versus equitable estoppel and being a different focus. Instead of tolling the statute, we look at it whether or not you can raise the statute of limitations defense at all if there's an equitable estoppel.
Right. In this case, first of all, there's no culpable defendant that's still alive, right? None of the defendants in this case are alleged to have made those representations, so I wonder whether equitable estoppel should bar them from asserting the statute of limitations.
Or do you have authority to that?
I don't have authority for that, Your Honor. The other issue is there are no allegations that Mr. Tinkham interfered with their knowledge of the claim. I mean, if we go back to the accrual analysis and look at the substance
of... It's not about the knowledge of the claim. The alleged interference is, don't worry, you don't have to assert your claim because I'm going to take care of you in the future.
But that does not cure the injury that occurs from them not getting paid at the time it's due. If you look at the Uniform Partnership Act,
right? But the argument is not that it wipes out the accrual. The argument is that under equitable estoppel, it prevents you from asserting the accrual, the statute of limitations. Not that it didn't accrue.
It doesn't prevent them from asserting their claim because they could still go to court and say, we are entitled to a buyout interest in this partnership, and we have not been paid it, regardless of whether Bill Tinkham was promising to pay it or not.
Right, but that's their reliance, right? We're going to forego this. We know we could do this. We're going to forego this. That's their reliance, which is a common denominator of all these equitable principles and doctrines. And so, you know, I wonder the same thing. Is the focus of our discussion too narrow? It doesn't seem as though, when you look at the formulations of equitable estoppel, fraudulent concealment, or even equitable tolling, it doesn't seem like any of those formulations narrowly say that the representation that prevented the lawsuit dealt with accrual. It's some fact that prevented the plaintiff from asserting the claim when they otherwise could have. I think it's broader than just knowledge about accrual or concealing accrual or focusing on whether the claim has accrued.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree because they were aware of all the facts of their existence of their claim. They were aware that they weren't getting paid. There was nothing about that required them to wait until Bill Tinkham finally died or sold the business.
No, nothing required them to, but that's not the requirement. The requirement isn't that they were required. The requirement is that they relied based upon the belief that they would get paid later. I don't know that there's a compulsory component to these doctrines. It's a reliance component. Not that they were forced or coerced, but that they relied.
If you look at the Spencer v. Estate of Spencer, it says the concealment has to be a fact necessary to commence a cause of action. So it's not only is reasonable reliance is necessary, but it has to be of a fact that is necessary to commencement of an action, right? And because they had all of the facts within their possession to commence this action, they could have, and as personal representatives of their father's estate, they should have moved forward. And so the equitable arguments don't get them out of the statute of limitations in this case. If you look at the accrual, the dissociation is the event that creates the right to payment. They had all of the knowledge they needed to assert that right, and they had the obligation to do that on the for the benefit of all the beneficiaries and the interested parties of the estate. They did not do that. They waited for more than a decade to assert this claim after the only individuals who know what happened in 2005 died, and now we have no real way to know what representations or what the agreement was between those parties. Bill Tinkham is not alive to defend himself with respect to the representations that he's alleged to have made, and we are standing here trying to sort this out. So we respectfully request the court affirm the decision of the circuit court below and grant judgment in favor of the appellants, or appellees. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Rishi. Mr. Bergeson, you can proceed with rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. There were a couple of items that were raised during opposing counsel's argument. First of all, it's improper to equate equitable estoppel and equitable tolling. They're distinct doctrines. Justice Devaney touched on that, where one tolls the statute of limitations under equitable tolling, which is arguably doesn't apply under some of the precedent by this court, most notably the Anson decision.
How about equitable tolling and fraudulent concealment? What's the difference between those two?
So I think that equitable estoppel and fraudulent concealment are different.
Equitable tolling and fraudulent concealment.
So I think that
fraudulent concealment operates as a tolling mechanism also.
Under the cases we presented, it appears to me that it's also an estoppel mechanism as well. But even under that, they have fraudulent concealment and equitable estoppel have very similar elements, but their critical distinction is that they estop a defendant from raising the statute of limitations, not that the statute of limitations is told.
The net effect is the same.
I'm sorry?
The net effect is the same. Whether you toll the statute or you prevent somebody from asserting it, the net effect is the same.
Correct.
It seems like a little bit of sleight of hand.
It may be some sleight of hand, but it is a critical distinction.
And I know you didn't create these doctrines from not holding it.
Correct. Correct. It is a little bit of sleight of hand, but the one improperly tolls and the other one properly stops, as equity allows. As is noted as well, Mr. Tinkham's representations of fact, not hiding the claim itself, just his representations of fact apply equitable estoppel. The other thing as well, we noted it in our brief, and there wasn't any briefing in response, but the notion that dissociation automatically causes accrual applies the statute of limitations under 15213 like a statute of repose. A statute of repose occurs automatically on a set event. You see it with substantial completion in construction cases. You see it in the medical malpractice cases that was most recently noted in the Pitt-Hart case. So by arguing that Dr. Nelson's death automatically accrues the claims because he was dissociated by operation of statute, it applies the 15213, which neither of the parties dispute is the proper statute of limitations here, as a statute of repose when it's clearly a statute of limitations. The debtor-creditor analogy, we presented case law and authority from this court saying that a debtor can be estopped from raising a statute of limitations defense if their conduct is prevents the creditor from timely filing their claim, their complaint. So we note that as well. Another thing is that ripeness is not equal accrual. I understand that they're related doctrines, but they're separate. There's been no authority saying that ripeness necessarily controls the accrual of claims. And finally, again, I want to direct the court's attention to the standard articulated by several cases, that accrual means notice of an injury or legal wrong. And here the claims are for breach and for conversion. And before 2022, the Nelson estate did not have any notice of any legal wrong. Mr. Tinkham didn't do anything that was adverse to their interests until he died, until his estate excluded the Nelson estate after previously including them in negotiations for the sale and sold the business without them. So that's the legal wrong that the court should look at when deciding the accrual matter. With that, I would conclude again, respectfully requesting that the court reverse the decision of the circuit court.
Can I stop you before you conclude?
Yes.
You talked about the distinctions between equitable tolling, equitable estoppel, and fraudulent concealment. Which theory do you think you prevail under, assuming accrual happened? Which theory do you think you prevail under, or do you think you prevail on all three?
So it's equitable estoppel and fraudulent concealment. I think both of those doctrines work hand in hand. I think Justice Salter noted that the elements are very similar in those cases, so I think those cases, those doctrines control. My time's concluded. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The case is fully submitted. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.